February 11th, just 1:34 p.m. And we have public hearings today on three different bills. Two are somewhat related, and we have both House Bill 2076 and 2081 were related to explanatory statements and other initiative issues, and these bills both were proposed in the interim by the Interim Committee on Judiciary, and because of that, we have asked Representative Williams to provide some information for us on these two bills. What I'd like to do, however, is actually open up public hearings simultaneously on 2076 and 2081 for Representative Williams' benefit, and once he's finished with his testimony, then we'll split it back apart. So if we can do that with a simultaneous public hearing on 2076 and 2081, Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I brought my lawyer with me. but I do appreciate the opportunity to briefly touch on both these bills, House Bill 2076 and House Bill 2081. And for the record, Representative Max Williams, House District 35, and with me is Greg Chamoff, Legislative Counsel. Starting with House Bill 2076, the purpose of this bill was really to address an issue that broadly arose in the context of explanatory statements and other issues related to the initiative, and a concern that the process that we have been in essentially allowing the court, for example, to rewrite ballot titles, was a situation where the court was exercising a function not part of its branch responsibility. In other words, it was a bit of a separation problem where they are actually writing the ballot title. And this arose in a case, and in subsequent conversations informally, the concern was also expressed that there might be similar problems with the court rewriting the language of the explanatory statement. So what this bill purports to do is to essentially develop a methodology by which the court could send the explanatory statement back either to the legislative committee that wrote the explanatory statement or the explanatory statement committee to allow a process for rewriting and clarifying that statement in an effort to really keep the separation of those powers clearly defined in the situation. And to give a little more context to that discussion, I asked Mr. Chamoff if it's appropriate with the chair to allow him to address the issue a bit more formally.
Sure. I'm Mr. Chair, members, Greg Chamoff, Legislative Counsel. When the Supreme Court's concern about rewriting ballot titles arose before the previous session, this body amended the statutes dealing with ballot titles to put together a procedure where if the Supreme Court finds a ballot title to be deficient, the Supreme Court then sends that title back to the Attorney General to be revised, and then if someone objects, to return for further review, so that the Supreme Court is not generally in the business of rewriting the ballot titles. House Bill 2076 puts together a similar procedure for explanatory statements. If a person objects to a statement either prepared by a explanatory statement committee or by the Legislative Council Committee, then and the Supreme Court agrees that the statement is insufficient, then rather than rewriting the statement, the Supreme Court would send the statement back to the appropriate committee for further reworking and, if necessary, further review.
Any questions on 2076? Yes, Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I'd like to ask you about Section 1, Subsection 3, the explanatory statement. Isn't it true that these statements are only needed for the voter's pamphlet after you, isn't it, you don't need it until you qualify for the ballot?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, yes.
So my concern is that by going through this court process that you're going to add more expense to the process, drive up the cost. Would that be true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, no. The timing of the review stays the same. The only difference in the procedure is instead of the Supreme Court saying whichever committee it is that wrote the statement, you didn't do it right, we're going to do it for you, they explain why the statement was done wrong and send it back to the committee to do it correctly. It takes the Supreme Court out of performing a task that the Supreme Court has suggested the legislature doesn't have the authority to require it to do.
Follow?
Sure, follow.
I'm a little confused. If you don't need it till you qualify for the ballot, then aren't you causing the petitioner to have to go through a process before they qualify that they might not need to go through until after they qualify?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, no. This procedure doesn't take place until after a measure is qualified for the ballot.
One last follow-up?
Sure.
Can you also tell me, and we're going to go into, I know, into House Bill 2081, but you have to conform these two bills together, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, at some point, if the measures are amending the same sections of the ORS, we would prepare conflict amendments so that the body could determine which of the two measures it preferred to move forward, either individually or together.
Thank you.
Anything further on 2076?
Yes.
Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need a little bit more background as to even how the ballot titles occur. When you say Legislative Council Committee, who is that? Is that you?
Madam Vice Chair, if you're talking about explanatory statements, there is a committee appointed in part by the Secretary of State or in part by leadership, depending upon whether a measure is a referral or an initiative. And that committee, called an explanatory statement committee, prepares the statement that explains the measure for the ballot. As a backup to that, the Legislative Council Committee, which is a statutory committee consisting normally of 11 members of the Legislative Assembly, Representative Williams is the House co-chair of that committee, prepares a statement to be used if the Explanatory Statement Committee can't agree on a statement. In my tenure with the Office of the Legislative Council, that hasn't happened. So there's never been a problem with an explanatory statement committee being unable to make up its mind and having to fall back on using the statement that we prepare as a safety valve. But we do prepare that safety valve statement in the event that the committee can't prepare one. Our office typically prepares the statement for review by the individual members of the committee, and if the committee itself desires changes in the statement, we make that before we tender that to the Secretary of State.
Follow up?
Yes.
So what I think you're saying is that Legislative Council comes up with an explanatory statement that then is sent to the Legislative Committee and they say okay and it's submitted.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moniz Anderson, essentially it's only as a fallback. The statements that are prepared by the Legislative Council's office and reviewed by the Legislative Council Committee are only used if there is a situation in which the actual explanatory statement committee, either appointed by House leadership if it's a legislative referral or appointed by the Secretary of State's office if it is an initiative, if they are unable to come to a conclusion and make a recommendation as an explanatory statement committee to the statement, then and only then does the Legislative Council Committee's approved statement replace that as a explanatory statement in the voter's pamphlet statement.
Thank you. So
that's the limited role. It's a very limited role, and that role is solely designed to be the backup role, so there is some explanation of the measure that would be included in the voter's pamphlet statement at the time the voter's pamphlet statement got distributed to the individuals. And so it's included in this list is where you would return the statement if the court found the statement to be insufficient. But by and large, subsection A of that section where it says the committee that filed the statement under RS 251.215, that's where the court would return it. In that instance, that's mostly where these things would go, because those are the statements that are really coming out of those committees for explanatory statement purposes. And they do on occasion get challenged. I don't know how often. Maybe Mr. Chamoff has a better idea of how often the explanatory statements are actually challenged.
Mr. Chairman and Vice Chair, I actually don't know the frequency. I know Mr. Neal is here, and he may have a better handle on that. In my tenure with the office, an explanatory statement prepared by a legislative committee was challenged once in the Supreme Court and upheld.
I know specifically about that case, having been one of the members of that explanatory statement committee, and was named in the lawsuit as it was proceeded in the Supreme Court on the challenge.
Okay. Any more questions on 2076? Yes, Representative Flores.
Either Representative Williams or Mr. Chamoff. Now, you stated that only one was challenged. One explanatory statement was challenged. Is it an ongoing, consistent problem, perhaps with the exception of recent past, that they're insufficient?
Well, I can only tell you, and I think Mr. Chamoff can identify the one that came out of a legislatively appointed committee. I honestly don't have a greater sense as to whether or not those that are appointed, those committees appointed by the Secretary of State's Office on Initiatives, have been in a situation where they've been more frequently challenged. The problem, again, is that the statement is prepared, essentially, whether it's through the initiative process, which is a function of legislative power, even though directed by the people and not by the body, or whether it's directed by a legislatively appointed committee to write the explanatory statement. The writing of the explanatory statement is a legislative function in the broadest sense of the word. And the reason that you don't want the Supreme Court rewriting explanatory statements is because they are not the legislative branch. And so that's the reason that you, and it's the same situation and the same theory that caused us to make a change to their rewriting of the ballot titles. In other words, they send it back to a branch who has responsibility for the creation of the language, but we don't put them in the role of rewriting, essentially, legislative text. Is that a fairly accurate way to describe the council?
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, yes.
Yes, you. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess what I'd just like to say is that the ballot title and the explanatory statement often determine a lot about the success of the outcome. And so I'm presuming that by changing this procedure, and rather than the person complains, goes to the Supreme Court, so forth, and now you have it coming back to the committee, you feel that there will be a finer tuning of the explanatory statement by a number of people who understand the process of getting things through. Would that be...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, I'm not sure that's, in fact, the result. The Supreme Court are pretty good writers, and so I don't know that I could say that the product that you would get out of the committee would necessarily be a better product than if we let the court just rewrite it. The point that I think this bill makes and the one we acted on last session is it doesn't matter how good of writers they are, they're the court, and they ought not be performing a legislative function. And to the extent that they are, any measure where there's been an explanatory statement that has been rewritten by the court presents itself being the subject of a lawsuit, and this raises the point raised by Representative Close, Mr. Chair. We want to fix this so it actually takes away the ability to challenge a measure based on the fact that the court rewrote an explanatory statement and therefore stepped outside of its constitutional limited power as that branch of government. So this actually, I think, prevents us from being embroiled in further litigation around the initiative process by making sure that the right people are writing the right parts of the process and we're not commingling these branch responsibilities.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. It's a good
lead-in, I think, Representative Williams, to House Bill 2081, in particular, one item you mentioned was the need for separation of powers, and we're seeing with 2081, I guess, still having the this is a decision about a ballot title, but I was wondering if in addition to 2081, you might also comment on how the Attorney General's office is the one basically drafting these ballot titles, and that being not part of the legislative branch, is there a way to connect the two?
Well, I would say, Mr. Chairman, that I think it's a very good question, and certainly one that I continue to have some concern about, because in the role of the executive, as they're drafting these ballot titles, I think there is a question again about whether or not that's a proper role. Mr. Chamoff could probably elucidate you in more detail about the legal issues surrounding that, but I think there's a broader policy question that is a legitimate one to pose. And more than once, in my thought, I have considered the possibility of suggesting that if we're going to have an office drafting the ballot title, it might very well and might ought be the Legislative Council's office, again recognizing that ballot titles are in fact an exercise of legislative function, whether or not they come from the initiative process through the people or through this body by way of referral. So that is an issue that I think is an appropriate one to raise. 2081, however, Mr. Chairman, was really pursued this bill in conversation with other people and put it through as a committee bill, in part to hopefully lay a framework for a broader discussion about where we handle the issue of review of these challenges to measures. And it seems to me, and whether or not it's the Court of Appeals or some other attenuated process, it seems to me that to relieve the Supreme Court of a function of this ballot title review, which happens on a very short time frame, and I think in conversations that I'm sure you will have, and many of you may have already had, with the members of the court, tends to really put an extreme burden on them from a time perspective, as they're having to deal with these ballot title issues on a regular basis, particularly when we appear to have and have had in recent time substantial numbers of these issues on the ballot in these cases being filed. So the idea was really to begin a discussion by this bill of whether or not it might make sense to remove this responsibility from the Supreme Court, invest it in the Court of Appeals, for example, and that's just an example, and that's what this bill proposes to do, is a way to offload that responsibility from the Supreme Court, who has a number of other mandated responsibilities that are not, again, that it can't shirk, everything from death penalty reviews to a number of other mandated issues that they have to deal with, not to mention the fact that there are fewer members of the Supreme Court, and therefore their turnaround time on all the other opinions that the world is waiting for them to decide is elongated as a result of their fact that they're spending so much time on these ballot measures. So again, I don't necessarily purport to sit here today and tell you that I am in my own mind even completely convinced that it ought to be the Court of Appeals that takes on this responsibility, but I think we do have to find some way to address the substantial burden this places on the Supreme Court in deciding these ballot title issues. Oftentimes, the decisions of which I think could, frankly, be left to some other approach. And that's the general nature of the bill and the reason that I brought it forward.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Williams, can you tell me how many ballot title cases there's been in the past 2 years?
Oh, I don't know. No, I couldn't, Representative Close, Mr. Chair. I don't have that number in front of me. I don't.
Sure. Would it be fair to say that there aren't that many ballot title cases?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Close, I think it depends on the timing and the cycle that we're in. I think over the last 4 years there has been a large number, and I believe you may even hear some testimony from the court today, or if not out, I think today potentially, about the level and the number of cases over time. I can't tell you within the last 2 years. I can tell you that in my conversations with members of the court and court staff at the Supreme Court, that they do spend a substantial amount of time based on how the process works addressing these ballot title challenges. Whether or not the volume is high at this particular moment, I can't tell you.
I would be interested in those numbers, really, for the past 5 years, Mr. Chair. Could I have one more follow-up?
Sure.
Representative Williams, you talked about the purpose of this bill, trying to take away the problem with the Supreme Court and their time constraint, and that by moving it to the Court of Appeals, you'd have less of a time constraint. Could you tell me, I understand on the Court of Appeals there's 10 judges, and they often refer items to a three-judge panel. So would it be fair to say that if we do this, we narrow it to just three people making the decision potentially? Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Close, if it worked effectively, you would have three-judge panels who would be making a determination about whether the ballot title was sufficient or whatever the challenge was. The idea would be, in fact, and the reason that this was at least an initial starting point for this discussion in my mind, was the ability of the Court of Appeals, in some cases, to meet en banc in the entire 10 members, and that could still happen in certain instances. But by and large, to resolve most of the run-of-the-mill ballot title challenges that occur in these cases in the three-judge panel process, I think, would create some efficiencies in getting the resolution done. And to the extent that the law is generally fairly defined in this area, I'm not sure that that creates, in my mind, a substantial problem. In fact, I see that potentially as a benefit.
Mr. Chair, I would just say that for those that are filing these petitions, I think they would see this as less access to the judicial system. And if you conform these two bills, then everything that was in the former bill would be at the Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. And that is the problem. Okay. Thank you.
Anything else? I guess my question, Representative Williams, on having the Court of Appeals basically as the final jurisdiction on this. What's your thoughts on that and not allowing any appeal to the Supreme Court on these issues?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I guess I think that in some cases one of the advantages of having a two-tiered appellate system is to make it operate efficiently, not necessarily extending complete appellate jurisdiction on every issue all the way to the Supreme Court, and that it makes some sense at times to define a court as the court of last resort on these issues. I mean, these ballot title challenges, I think, could be as effectively handled at the Court of Appeals level without necessarily being allowed to proceed to a Supreme Court determination as not. Right now, these are filed directly with the Supreme Court, and they're the court of last resort on this issue. So it's not as if they get two bites of the apple. I mean, they're filed directly with the Supreme Court, so the Court of Appeals doesn't weigh in. So they would still have a court, just like they have now, looking at this issue. It's just not the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. And do you know of any other issues or areas that the Court of Appeals is that, I guess, the last resort? Are there any other? I'm just trying to put this in a classification
right.
With anything else.
Yeah, not right off the top of my head, Mr. Chairman. I can't tell you. I do think there are a couple of things where we have limited jurisdiction that may stop at the Court of Appeals level. I know in a number of other jurisdictions, they've divided their court responsibilities up in such a way as that not everything gets sort of multiple bites of the apple as it moves through the process, particularly when it's of a almost more administrative nature. But again, I'm sure that the witnesses from the court, to the extent there are any, will be able to address those questions for the committee.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Representative Williams? Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate your assistance. And with that, we will close the simultaneous public hearing of 2076 and 2081, and then just reopen a public hearing only on 2076. And let's bring Fred Neal up again. All right. Did you have testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Chair Doyle, members of the committee, I'm Fred Neal. I'm one of the managers in the State Elections Division in the Secretary of State's office, and I'm the voters pamphlet supervisor. And in regards to House Bill 2076, I do have, I certainly am prepared to answer any questions you have about the explanatory statement process, how they're developed, how they're adopted, and how they get in the voters pamphlet. Mr. Garza is here from the legal counsel to the Supreme Court to answer questions about the number of appeals and the timing of them. We do have a concern, certainly no concern with the policy issue, which is yours to decide, about separation of powers and whether it's appropriate for the Supreme Court itself to be drafting the explanatory statement that ends up being printed in the voter's pamphlet. That's your call to make in regards to Representative Williams' bill. We do have some concern that if you allow for this continuous loop or potential continuous loop of appeal from an explanatory statement, and as we understand the criteria in the statute now, that's the explanatory statement, whichever committee adopts it, shall be impartial, simple, and understandable, and not exceeding 500 words. At some point, we need to get final copy of what is to go in the voter's pamphlet to the printer so that it can 1.6 million copies can be printed and distributed statewide. Currently, there is a statute, 251-230, that allows a little escape valve for the Secretary of State in trying to print the voter's pamphlet, that if either the Citizens Explanatory Statement Committee, which is two proponents, two opponents, and then the four of them pick a fifth member, if three or more of them can't adopt a statement, then, as Mr. Chamoff said, the fallback statement adopted by the Legislative Council Committee is then what we are directed by statute to print. If neither the Explanatory Statement Committee nor the Legislative Council Committee adopts a statement, the 230 says the measure shall be printed in the voter's pamphlet without the explanatory statement. Because this process is really pretty much after Labor Day, when you're expecting an opinion coming back from the Supreme Court on whether, let's say, for a general election voter's pamphlet, which is where most contention lies in the initiated measures, where you'll see more appeals, if there's the potential of us not getting a certified explanatory statement in time to get final copy to the printer and get it printed. And so we would simply, if you're going to pursue this approach, that you do provide an amendment to 230 that allows us to proceed with printing the voter's pamphlet without an explanatory statement for that measure if we have not gotten a certified statement from the Supreme Court by, and our recommendation would be by the 55th day before the election, would allow us to meet the printing mandates.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Neal? Perhaps I'm close.
Mr. Chair, this would regard to House Bill 2146, correct?
No, 2076.
I'm sorry. I had questions on the other bill. Thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you. And Mr. Garza, we have you just to answer questions if needed. The Supreme Court Legal Counsel, why don't you come on up and we can at least ask about some of these statistics that were being inquired earlier.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Keith Garza. I'm the Supreme Court Senior Staff Attorney.
Okay, great. There were questions earlier about, just the numbers of cases that have to be reviewed by the court. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes. In respect of the question as to how many explanatory statement review proceedings there have been over the past few years, my calculations indicate, starting in 1990, that there have been 13 such review proceedings brought before the Supreme Court. That averages out to about a couple an election cycle. And that's what we really prepare for in the late summer of an election year, to receive one or two or maybe three such proceedings. For the 2002 general election, there were no proceedings filed. For the 2000 general election, there were three such proceedings filed. My records suggest that the court has modified the explanatory statement in 7 of the 13 proceedings and simply certified it as sufficient in the other 6. So it's about a 50% success rate for cases that are brought in the Supreme Court. Concerning the ballot title review proceedings that the court received.
Before you move on, do you have anything showing what or how much time the court is taking with those explanatory statements?
I do not. I have not tracked separately statistics for the timeliness of the court's dispositions in explanatory statements, and for the following reason. They normally come in mid to late August of the election year. I mean, I think Representative Williams had explained about the unusual proceeding in which he was involved, which came, I think, for either primary or special election. But normally we expect to receive these matters, you know, right about in the middle of August. And then at that point, what I do on behalf of the court is work with the Secretary of State's Elections Division to determine essentially when the drop-dead date is for preparation of the voter's pamphlet, because that's really the deadline against which the court, as a practical matter, is working. I think most of the cases, from my recollection of them, are decided in either late August or in early September. So it's about a 2 or 3 week turnaround. What happens is there are 5 days from the filing of the revised final explanatory statement within which any person can seek review in the Supreme Court, provided, I believe, that some comments were made to the draft explanatory statement. That's kind of the jurisdictional trigger for the court. Once that's met and a petition is filed, the committee has, I believe it's 7 calendar days within which to file an answering memorandum in support of the statement. And then at that point, the case is at issue. And historically, what the court did at that point was attempt to schedule oral argument, have the parties come in and provide oral argument to the court so that then the court could take the case under advisement and issue a decision, which normally was in the form of a written opinion. And we haven't had any explanatory statements for the last couple of years. However, in the kind of analogous context of ballot title review proceedings, the court, as an internal manner, has stopped permitting oral argument as a matter of course, and instead has been taking the cases under advisement simply when the written materials are complete. And so that would affect, I think, in the future, were the court to use that process for an explanatory statement case, it would mean that the case would actually be before the justices for decision earlier than it has been in the past. And normally, I think the cases take, you know, a week or a week and a half for the court to come up with the decision and to issue an opinion.
And did you have any further?
Sure, I was just going to respond to the question about the number of ballot title review proceedings that have been filed. I started keeping records of that for the 1998 election cycle, and I didn't keep very close records in 1998, but I tracked about 48 cases challenging petitions filed challenging a ballot title. For the 2000 election cycle, there was a substantial jump to 92 proceedings before the court. And for the 2002 general election cycle, there were 96 proceedings. And for this coming election cycle for 2004, I think the court has already received, you know, probably around 10. I think on the curve it is ahead of where it was last cycle in the number of proceedings that have been filed.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Garza? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. How about Cappy Eaton?
Chair and members of the committee, I'm going to be very brief. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the government chair of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League is a nonpartisan political organization, grassroots, that seeks to make sure that elections are in the interests of the electorate. And to that point is why I'm speaking in favor of this measure. Explanatory statements in our analysis of them do not always provide the voters with a reasonable explanation of what's going on. So it is our belief that the ability of the Supreme Court to refer back to the appropriate committee is a good move, and that their review of the explanatory committee could be a little more thorough. Explanatory committees for initiative measures have a very truncated time frame. They have to do this at a very short period of time, and not always have we felt was there a good explanatory statement where it looked at all the implications. So we would hope that the Supreme Court, in taking a look at that, would refer back to the appropriate committee if they felt that this was the case, rather than rewriting it themselves. But in any event, they would be in a good position to review such cases. We did have one question about the measure, and that it appeared to us that there was no sort of ending time, that you could go on forever if the committee came back with a statement and back to the Supreme Court. Perhaps we didn't read into it where there was a closing time, but it just seemed to us that there was no closing time. You know, they can do this twice, and then something else will happen, like going to legislative council or whatever, but we would like to have that addressed. But in general, we think this is a good procedure to take the Supreme Court out of having to fulfill that legislative duty.
Okay, any questions from Seaton? Ms. Seaton, do you... Oh, Representative Eklund, do you have something?
No.
Okay, Ms. Seaton. Oh, sure. Representative Mon Sanderson.
Thank you. Are we, Mr. Chair, are we going to have a work session on this? No, yeah. I would recommend that if the League of Women Voters wanted an amendment, they should talk to Representative Williams to submit their your recommendation.
We can talk to Representative Williams about this, yes.
Okay. Satan, you're...
Mr. Chairman?
Oh.
I wondered if I might just clarify something on... The written statement says that one of the reasons that they support it is that it gives the Supreme Court an opportunity to further review and modify and explain. And my understanding is that it moves it back to the Legislative Council Committee and out of the court. So where am I confused?
Well, we might bring Mr. Chamoff up to answer that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, assuming that this procedure works as the current procedure for ballot titles, the Supreme Court, if it finds the statement to be deficient, will explain why it finds the statement to be deficient. There isn't a discussion of a particular part of the measure or a part of the measure is overstated, something like that, and then refers the measure back to the Explanatory Statement Committee to essentially follow the Supreme Court's suggestions. So although the Supreme Court isn't rewriting the statement, there would be, we expect, a substantial amount of guidance from the Supreme Court, and then the actual rewriting would be done by the Explanatory Statement Committee. The only time that the Legislative Council Committee would get involved is if the Explanatory Statement Committee can't come up with a modified version of the statement to tender back to the Secretary of State.
Okay. I just wanted to be sure that the League of Women Voters understood that it was, this was trying to make a shift from the court back to the legislative council committee. I don't know. I just keep getting the feeling that we're trying to fix something not broken. Maybe I'm the only one on the committee that feels that way. But
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, I don't think that anyone is suggesting that the Supreme Court is doing anything other than an exemplary job in rewriting explanatory statements. However, regardless of the skill with which they're doing the rewriting, it's not a task that the Supreme Court under our Constitution has been assigned.
Thank you. Any other questions of Ms. Eaton? Ms. Eaton, just you were commenting earlier that at least this is a step in the right direction. Do you have thoughts on what you believe the ideal model to be in this kind of dealing with this issue?
We certainly have spent some time in the league talking about that, but I really couldn't discuss that with you right now. But for a long time, we felt that there could be some better ways of informing the public through an explanatory statement than what happens now. And how that could be done, this is perhaps one of the ways to do that. But if I could answer Representative Verger, our understanding with what the Supreme Court would do with this, they now get them referred, they can rewrite them if they want to. This would give them an opportunity not to rewrite it, but to perhaps, as we've just been counseled, would be able to issue some comments if they felt that the statement was insufficient to explain what the ballot measure was all about. And that's one of our concerns, is that many voters really do read in the voter's pamphlet the explanatory statement of a ballot, and that's why we feel it's a very important piece of the whole elections process.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I simply believe that it is an extremely important part of the ballot measure to have the explanatory statement, and I understand that. In your written statement, you also refer to a time that you might like, a time frame. Do you intend to suggest a particular time frame?
Well, I think our concern was that I think Mr. Neal referred to sort of a continuous challenge. Is there at a certain time other than the deadline of the voter's pamphlet when it has to be closed down? Is there a time certain when you would say, in essence, enough already, but close off the ability to keep challenging? So, and I don't know exactly how legally you can do that, but it was of concern to us.
Okay, great. All right, anything further, Ms. Eaton? Great, thank you.
Thank you.
And Ross Day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For your record, Ross Day, Oregonians in Action. Here today in opposition to House Bill 2076 as it's currently written. I think Representative Verger hit the nail on the head. This is a solution looking for a problem. As you heard earlier, explanatory statement challenges are rare. I'm only aware of one. I believe it was in 1998. I've not been a party to, nor have I, read any of the decisions regarding explanatory statement challenges. That being said, the changes in House Bill 2076 clearly reflect a policy, a change in policy for this legislature to make. I would say one thing, that this court does, this body does have the constitutional authority to prescribe the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court above and beyond interpretation of our Constitution. I would say that. So it is entirely proper for you to direct review of ballot titles to the Supreme Court. In that sense, our concern is that House Bill 2076 would add an unnecessary step to the process. That is to say that it gives the Supreme Court the opportunity, the option, if you will, to refer a measure back to an explanatory statement committee or a legislative council committee or the like. The bill as it's currently written does mirror ballot title process, which also grants the Supreme Court that option. It doesn't say that they have to refer it back. It says shall modify or shall refer, basically send back to the... So this bill still gives the Supreme Court that authority. Our concern is that measures may be sent back for reasons that are, you know, that are wholly inconsistent with prior decisions. Further, I think Representative Close hit touched on this briefly too, and I won't get into 2081 too much, except to say that in the event House Bill 2081 were to become law as well, that measure replaces the Court of Appeals with the Supreme Court, which would mean that you would have essentially panels of three judges on the Court of Appeals, presumably coming to different conclusions. Some panels modifying the explanatory statement, and some panels not modifying the explanatory statement and instead referring it back to explanatory statement committee. So for those reasons, as currently written, we would oppose House Bill 2076. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Day? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. No one further listed to testify on 2076, so we'll close the public hearing and now open up the public hearing on 2081. And Mr. Nass,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Jim Nass, legal counsel for the appellate courts. I've been working for the courts for about 20 years now and visiting this body occasionally. And whenever we've had a problem with legislation, I'm usually able to offer some sort of option. If you don't like it this way, we do it some other way. With this bill, I'm at the point of... we don't like this one, as you might well have... Yes. The Oregon Court of Appeals is one of the most efficient and productive intermediate courts in the nation. It used to be number two. I think it slipped to number nine. But wherever we sit in the lineup there, it is a hardworking court with a great many cases. We don't see how transferring the jurisdiction of this bill is actually going to transferring the jurisdiction of this of these kinds of cases to that court is going to overall help the system. Somebody somewhere has to do this work. The other problem that we see is that the Court of Appeals, being a 10-judge court that sits in panels of three, doesn't move as fast. Even though they often break their work down into panels of three, even those panels of three usually only meet once every two to three weeks. The Supreme Court, by contrast, usually holds oral argument during the first week of each month, and they hold a conference after each oral argument on each day. They also meet on Tuesday of every week to consider draft opinions and other matters that come before the court. So they are meeting on a regular basis. The Supreme Court has been doing this work since 1927, and over those years they've developed a quick and efficient way to handle them. While certainly the Court of Appeals could modify its processes to do the same thing, we're wondering why have that court duplicate the same speed with which the other court already is doing its work. I think those are the primary reasons, and actually, yeah, those are the primary reasons why we oppose this bill. Representative Williams suggested that maybe this is just kind of a shot across the bow, and that what we're trying to do here is to talk about other, some other ways to do this, and we are certainly open to talking about other ways to do ballot title review. As I sat listening to the testimony on House Bill 2076, and we started thinking in terms of turnaround times of 2 to 3 weeks, the Court of Appeals, at least based on its historical practice, is totally unsuited to that kind of turnaround time. We do land use cases that we are required to decide within 91 days of the date of oral argument, and most of the time we make that, but it's oftentimes very hard to do that. Now, these cases don't always raise, obviously, the kinds of issues that land use cases do, but still the time pressure would be unbelievable, and we already have a court with a settled process in place for handling it, and although we're open to other kinds of options, we're not too keen on this one. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I want to follow up on one of the questions that was asked of Representative Williams, and pick your brain for a second on this, on the question. I believe that there are some areas of law in which the first appeal goes to the Court of Appeals, and then there's either a mandatory or discretionary appeal to the Supreme Court. I'm not aware of areas in which the final court of appeal is the Court of Appeals. Are you?
No, I am not. I believe you're right. I'm not aware of any kind of case for which the Court of Appeals decision is final as a matter of law.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nass, that was very succinct and to the point. Testimony, I appreciate the bullets. Makes it really clear. Could I ask you, you mentioned the time constraint, that this might kind of cause a log jam. Do you think that, could it happen that all other appeals would be put on hold and the court would just have to do ballot title appeals?
Mr. Representative Close, I wouldn't say that all cases would be, because the Court of Appeals, since it does historically sit in panels of three, if you had during any one election cycle one panel handling all of those, and of course the other two panels would go on with their work, but it certainly would mean for that panel they might not get much else done during that cycle. The other concern I would have is that you might be left with one of two situations. Either you might end up with the same three judges year after year doing these, or if you spread the work around, you might end up with the three different panels coming out with somewhat inconsistent results. Now the court has a process to avoid that happening, where its staff attorneys meet just before an opinion goes out, and there's a staff attorney assigned to work with each of the three panels, and when the opinions are ready to go out, they meet as a group and they go over them to try to spot where one panel may be doing something different than a different than another panel is doing. With the time frames that we're talking about here, I'm afraid that we wouldn't have that luxury.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is a hypothetical question, but what would the Supreme Court say if we were to ask it, do you approve or enjoy or appreciate the task of doing explanatory statements since 1927? Would they say, we wish somebody else would be doing this rather than the Oregon Supreme Court?
Mr. Chair, Representative Backman, I may have to take the fifth on that. No. My best guess, I don't work with the Supreme Court on a day-to-day basis with preparation of its opinion, so I don't really know. My best guess is that it is to some extent wordsmithing. It's reading a measure and trying to summarize it within the confines of what the statute says in terms of number of words and what I can say and so on. So it probably isn't the most professionally satisfying work, But we understand that it's work that someone needs to do, and it is vital to our elections process. So we all do work that we're not necessarily might choose to do, but somebody has to do it.
Mm-hmm. Follow up?
Yes, follow up.
Thank you. I'm just wondering if we were starting absolutely afresh, brand new, and one of the courts had to do this, the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, which one would be chosen to do it? I think that'd be an interesting exercise. Obviously, we're not doing that, but it would be interesting to see which court would win that distinction. Win in quotes.
Not lose.
Actually, Mr. Nass provided that answer in his written testimony. So, are there any other questions, Mr. Nass?
I would. Perhaps I could editorialize, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
Yeah, thank you. My thought was, and I'm not being critical at all, Mr. Nass, of what you said, but I guess because we've always done things a certain way, and you have certain procedures, wouldn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't consider changing those procedures. I sometimes think it's refreshing to have to rethink and redo, maybe, although I'm not criticizing the Circuit Court of Appeals at all. So it is an argument that you've used, and it may or may not be valid, I guess is what I'm saying.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Certainly.
I happen to share that view merely because we've done something one way doesn't mean we always need to keep on doing it. And if shifting responsibility for ballot title review, explanatory statement review, and fiscal impact statement review to the Court of Appeals would solve a problem, then I would be in favor. I think we all would favor it. But it's not clear to me how it's solving anything. The Supreme Court still has to meet on the cycle that it meets, oral argument first of the month, and then, I mean, it doesn't have to, but it chooses to. That's the most efficient way for it to do its business. So moving this category of cases away from them won't change that. It simply imposes a new burden on the Court of Appeals to come up with a new expedited case processing process, and it's just not clear to me that that's a wise use of our resources.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Nass.
Thank you.
Okay, Ross Day.
It's me again. Once again, Mr. Chair, for your record, Ross Day, Director of Legal Affairs at Oregonians in Action, and once again, here in opposition to House Bill 2081. I think I want to highlight, first, let me answer Representative Backlund's question about what the Supreme Court would say. I believe there's dicta going back several years, and Justice Lindy was my advisor at Willamette, and I can represent to you that he wasn't too thrilled about the ballot title review process that the Supreme Court currently has the pleasure of performing. But with that being said, I want to highlight one of the things that Mr. Nass said and suggest to you that this is probably why it's best left at least with the Supreme Court, if not some other body that is consistent, and that is consistency. The Court of Appeals currently meets, generally speaking, with a three-judge panel, and there exists under 2081 the very real likelihood that you could get inconsistent results, the Court of Appeals internal procedures notwithstanding. But you might get inconsistent results. And specifically, with regard to the law on ballot title review, which I heard, I think it was Representative Williams who said it was a pretty well-defined area of law. I would beg to disagree with Representative Williams. It's what constitutes an accurate ballot title varies. I mean, it's a pretty broad spectrum. And I think the necessity that we have consistency in the ballot title process, explanatory statement process, and the like is important. And having the same seven people decide these issues, I think, is also important.
Further, the Court of Appeals has what's called has mandatory review. That is, they have to review. Now, it's true many of their decisions are what we call in the business AWOPT, but they still have mandatory review, so they have to take these cases. Whereas Supreme Court review is discretionary, giving them a little bit more time, although I'm not suggesting by any sense they have all the time in the world, but a little bit more time to hear some of these cases as well. But our primary concern is consistency, and that is that we may not be able to get the same decisions every time you have a ballot title challenge. One ballot title may be okay with one panel, but not with the other. And finally, I do want to echo some other statements made by Mr. Ness. The Court of Appeals does do a good job reviewing their cases, and they work very conscientiously, but they do have a backlog, and they work very hard to get those cases out. And adding another layer of cases that they have to hear without any further appeals, which just places an undue burden on them. And I think that last point needs to be stressed, and that is there is no other appeals under this bill. Your Court of Last Resort is the Court of Appeals. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
And I guess just to follow up on that, as we see the potential, if it goes down to a three-person panel making what could be inconsistent decisions, then there is no recourse.
Exactly. You have no. If you've got one panel deciding one thing in one way and another panel deciding another way, you're stuck. You can't move any further. So,
yeah. Any other questions, Mr. Day?
Chairman, could we have written testimony, for instance? Could I ask that he give us some written testimony? It's really helpful if we have it with our packet, so when we're going over before the work session.
I don't have any written testimony prepared, but I'd be happy to send the committee a letter if that would be
great.
Of assistance.
Thank you.
And I guess before you move on, we move beyond this. Just as we're starting to look at these issues, I mean, do you have thoughts on ways to make the system work better?
Well, Mr. Chair, there have been a number of proposals by political scientists, I should say, across the country, where they have employed systems where you've had a jury of citizens draft ballot titles or explanatory statements, or much the same way a grand jury sits. They've attempted to employ processes like that. In 2000, the state of Washington had a ballot measure that didn't make it to the ballot, but it received a significant number of signatures. State of Minnesota also attempted to employ the same sort of system, to take it out of the courts and keep it in the legislature. I agree with Representative Williams that the ballot title drafting process and the explanatory statement process are legislative functions. I agree with that. But the history, my understanding of the history behind why the courts have these functions, why they perform these functions, is the theory of impartiality on behalf of our judicial system, and that, you know, they're the final arbiter of these disputes, and so that's why it's over there. These other proposals that I have seen employ to a certain extent that same theory, that is a grand jury, it's made up of our peers, if you will, who might be able to come up with an explanatory statement, ballot titles, or and the like. So I think that's a thought, at least. I would be happy to work with the committee and anyone else, if the chair is interested, in forming a work group on reforming the ballot title process and how those are drafted and reviewed and so on and so forth, because I certainly think that does need to be looked at this session.
Thank you. All right. Other questions for Mr. Bingham? Great. Thank you. And Mr. Garza, any comments to add, or just to answer questions? Okay. Any questions for the Supreme Court attorney?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure this is really appropriate, but I have a comment that it concerns me a great deal that this bill seems to change the symmetry of the way we handle appellate decisions in Oregon, which is the point of the question I asked earlier. I'm very concerned about the idea that we would end an appellate review at the Court of Appeals without the Supreme Court having the capacity to regulate that by either a discretionary or a mandatory review later. And of course, having a two-stage review of something that has to be done this quickly doesn't make sense either, just because of the process of time. By process of elimination, that leaves the system we have now, or something like it.
Okay. Anything further on this bill before we close the public hearing? Great. Public hearing is then closed, 2081, and let's now open up a public hearing on 2146. Mr. Lindback. And Mr. Lindback, just as a reminder for you and for the rest of the committee, we have another meeting to go off to at 3 o'clock, which gives us only about 20 minutes, and only one other individual scheduled to testify, but not sure where, how far along you want to go with this today, but if we can just ask you to just be mindful of the time.
I'll keep my comments brief. For the record, harkening back to the last conversation, because somebody has to do it, I'm John Lindback, the Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. House Bill 2146 is proposed to you by the Elections Division of the Secretary of State and the county clerks as a result of what happened in New York City on September 11th. People have forgotten that September 11th, 2001, was Election Day in New York City. They had to postpone that election. They had no statutory framework under which to make that decision. And it all worked out, but it made elections administrators around the country pretty comfortable that there was no statutory framework for, in the event of something cataclysmic like that, that could affect an entire city, but there was nobody empowered in the heat of the moment by statute to make that decision. So the bill that you have in front of you today, House Bill 2146, is an attempt to have a conversation starter with the legislature about placing somebody in charge of making that decision. This particular bill, because the Secretary of State is the chief elections official of the state, places the Secretary of State in charge of making that decision and places some parameters around it. Whether or not you feel the parameters presented by this bill are loose or too tight or whatever, we'd like to have a conversation with you about that. We're very open in regards to what this bill says and, frankly, open about who should make the decision. We just think that somebody needs to be able to make the decision, and so we're proposing this as a place to start the conversation. Section 2 of the bill, I'd like to call your attention that it says that if the Secretary determines that it would be impossible or impracticable, for electors to cast ballots or for elections officials to tally ballots due to that series of circumstances, then it would empower the Secretary to write a proclamation postponing the election. And those circumstances are A, civil disorder, B, a state of emergency declared under ORS 401-055, which is the governor's declaration of emergency statutes, and unanticipated grave natural disaster, etc., any other catastrophic event. So I will stop my comments there in order to keep them brief and answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. The way this is worded, or the way this is set up, would this contemplate a situation in which, make up a hypothetical, in which something occurs the day before Election Day, things are in a mess, and the Secretary of State, in effect, says, we will allow you to get your mailed ballot in a week late. Is that what you've got in mind, or is it something else, something different?
Well, I think really what the bill was about was something that's so cataclysmic that you'd want to reschedule the entire election, sort of cancel it and start over, like they did in New York City. I can foresee certain circumstances where if you had a problem, say, in one county, let's say that we had a general election, we had a problem with flooding in Marion, Benton, and Linn counties or something, where those folks, where the mail was not getting through, where folks were not able, the transportation was impeded, election workers were not able to get to the elections offices in order to assist the county elections officials with processing ballots and tallying them. We could foresee some kind of situation where you may want to address the situation just for those counties and withhold the announcement of results in all other counties to give people in the counties that are having a problem time to deal with that problem and participate in the election. But really what this bill was aimed for was something that's very large and cataclysmic.
The situation on September 11th, of course, in New York is very different from our electoral system, because our election really goes on for about 8 weeks or thereabouts, depending upon when you think about when ballots go out. So you're contemplating that if that process got interrupted somewhere along the line, you might just stop and start over again another time. Did you think about the possibility of simply pushing it out a little bit so that the process you're involved in already could be finished? I mean, that would be one possibility, appears to me, as a modification for this bill.
That's correct. I agree with you.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, I appreciate that. You know, I know where you're going on this, and I would agree that because we have the mail ballot, we don't have to ask people to try to go to the polls during a disaster. But my concern would be that this would send a message to terrorists that if they want to stop an election, you know, they just riot, and because this is so wide open with civil disorder, they could stop an election that way. And I don't know how you avoid that, but I guess make it tighter.
Yeah. Well, we're fully open to changes in the language. If civil disorder is too loose, we can work on that.
Yes, Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, on the very last sentence of the bill, and specifying the date the election will be held, do you anticipate how broadly to be interpreted is that? Could you say in 6 months or 1 month or 2 weeks, or should there be some limits imposed a bit on the Secretary of State to declare the new election so that it's fairly expeditious?
Yeah, I'd have no problems with that if you wanted to add language there. I think the sort of natural forces at work in an election, people want a decision. There are a lot of candidates. I think there would be a lot of pressure on whoever is making this decision not to delay it for 2 years.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there are natural forces at work here, but we have no problem with setting parameters here.
Anything else? Mr. Lindbeck, I'm trying to think if there was such an event that, you know, the decision was made. I mean, and say it was, I mean, just without this law, and the Secretary of State just on his own says, I'm going to declare this, you know, to cancel this election. So what? I mean, what would happen? I mean, is it, you know, there's concern that there would be lawsuits, the concern that that he's acting outside his scope? Where's the problem?
Lawsuits and challenges to the outcome of the election. People arguing that if you let the election happen, that people were disenfranchised because of the disaster. A lawsuit filed that says because you postponed it, it really could have gone through without any problem, and then you go through litigation on that. In general, elections are minefields of opportunities for people to sue. And they do it. I mean, my legal budget is just astounding. And so when we see an event like what happened on September 11th and people acting without clear statutory authority, the antennas go off, like we're asking for lawsuits there. And I don't think people who are candidates on ballots or folks who have worked very hard to have an initiative on a ballot, either to forward or defeat it, do not want the results of that election called into question or clouded by an issue like this. It's just better to have some clear statutory authority for these decisions.
Okay, thank you. All right, appreciate your comments. And let's see, we can bring up Annette Nguyen-Ham.
Chair Doyle and members of the committee, I'm Annette Nguyen-Ham. I'm the Lane County Elections Official, and I'm here on behalf of the Association of County Clerks. I'll be very brief. Basically, as county clerks, we have discussed this issue, and certainly when September 11th occurred, we were concerned what would we do if we experienced this particular situation. And we also talked further about it. There have been some different situations that have occurred that we've had close calls where we've had some flooding. Clackamas County had some flooding. Tillamook County had some flooding at different occasions near elections. There was an earthquake in Klamath Falls. Multnomah County had a fire across the street. Luckily, we kept on, nothing was deterred, and we were not affected by any particular scheduled election, but the potential is there. We have all thought about elections. If we had a fire in one of our office and the ballots were destroyed or something, what would we do? Well, the first thing that we would do is we would turn to the Secretary of State's office for direction. I should probably say the first thing we would do is see how we could continue to conduct the election and see it through its conclusion, because our goal is always to do that. We try to rise to the heroics of the situation. But sometimes we don't have the solution, and we have to turn to the Secretary of State for that direction. And we felt that there wasn't that latitude for him to or her to turn around and give us some solution that was workable. So we felt there was at least an opportunity here to discuss this with the committee here.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. I guess, would you envision there would be a time, I guess, when there's an individual event, maybe in one county, you mentioned Tillamook as an example, on a statewide election where the secretary then would be able to call off the entire election because of something that's happening in one county?
Well, I certainly think that there's the potential that something could happen unexpected in one of our counties during a countywide election, statewide election, that we would have to make some very hard decisions. And what those decisions would be right now, there's nothing in the statutes that make a provision for us to make a choice of what that decision would be, whether it would be to try to replace the ballots if some were destroyed by accident, or, you know, like in a fire, for instance, or that a segment of the population couldn't get to a certain area, so you had to set up a certain poll, maybe an emergency poll, so that they could go to an area because there was an earthquake. It's really difficult to hypothetically guess all the calamities that could happen. We certainly hope that nothing would happen. We'd never have to exercise that, but it would be wise for us to be prepared for that event.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for your testimony. We'll go ahead and close the hearing on 2146. And note, committee, that we are scheduled for the Joint Rules Committee meeting at 3 o'clock, the Senate Rules, and that's in room 343. And have a presentation at that point. We are kind of starting the kickoff now just on initiative issues. I think we'll have a good presentation this afternoon, and we'll be picking this up again on Thursday and see where that takes us. So with that, we're adjourned.
We haven't talked about a half an hour.